Russia continues its devastating attacks on Ukraine's power grid.
I should say that, of course, it was really tough 2 days, because when it's no electricity, it's no heating most of the places. And, well, weather is quite bad as well for this past couple of days.
Plus the dire conditions in Kherson as residents queue for much-needed water and heating fuel to face winter temperatures.
You have holes the size of swimming pools in the main highway leading up to the city that was caused by heavy artillery, completely decimated houses and gas stations and schools and shopping centers.
And later in the program, a song of solidarity for Ukraine from Africa sung by a local Lviv band and a popular Ugandan singer. Today is Friday, November 25th. From the Voice of America, this is Flashpoint Ukraine. Good evening. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. On winter's doorstep, European Union nations have not been able to surmount bitter disagreements as they struggle to effectively shield 450 million citizens from massive increases in their natural gas bills as cold weather sets in. An emergency meeting of energy ministers on Thursday only showed how the energy crisis tied to Russia's war in Ukraine has divided the 27-nation bloc in almost irreconcilable groups. The EU's energy commissioner, Kadri Simson, said that she never expected the deal to pass.
It was always foreseen that today there will be no decision made on market correction mechanism that we presented only 2 days ago.
Adding that her office was ready to provide presidents and ministers all the necessary data so that they could take them into account in negotiations. Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky also called upon Europeans to stay united and impose a much lower price cap on Russian oil than many were considering. Also on Thursday, European Commission Chief Ursula von der Leyen said that during a visit to Finland, the bloc was writing another sanctions package on Russia, saying that the EU will not rest until, quote, Ukraine has prevailed over Putin in his unlawful and barbaric war, end quote.
The Ukrainian people, because of Putin's barbaric terroristic attack on the country's civil infrastructure, must face this oncoming winter with no electricity and in many places no running water. Because of him, babies, their parents and grandparents are freezing in the dark. And I strongly condemn these barbaric attacks. They are war crimes. But I also know that our Ukrainian friends will overcome this tragedy because they are strong and their cause is just. And we, the European Union, stand here by them in these very difficult times as long as it takes.
Russia denies deliberately targeting civilians in Ukraine, but acknowledges a campaign of strikes against electric power and other infrastructure, which Moscow suggests are aimed at reducing Kyiv's ability to fight and pushing it towards negotiations. On Friday, much of Ukraine remained without heat or power after the most devastating Russian airstrikes on its energy grid thus far. Kyiv residents were warned to brace for further attacks, as well as to stock up on water, food, and warm clothing. Anna Chernikova has more as she joins us from the Ukrainian capital.
For 2 days in a row, Ukraine had almost no electricity and water supply. If we talk about Kyiv, yesterday water supply was back at around noon and electricity was not back at all. So we got electricity back today. I should say that, of course, it was really tough 2 days because when it's no electricity, it's no heating most of the places. And, weather is quite bad as well for this past couple of days. People across Ukraine, they do suffer from the consequences of this latest attack. It was like something on top of the previous. And of course, the consequences are longer, critical consequences are longer. But according to Ukrainian energy company, it will take around 2 additional days to actually stabilize the system until the outages could be back under the schedule.
And Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky has said that the war began with Russia annexing Crimea and it will end with Crimea's return to Ukraine. He has brought up the subject yet again.
Recently, President Zelensky said that he is open for proposals of non-military returning of Crimea under Ukrainian control. However, he said that if there would be any proposition, like any suggestions or any negotiations, which would include a discussion about Crimea being not under Ukrainian control, he is not accepting that. He highlighted that Crimea is an important and integrity part of Ukraine. We heard the reaction from Kremlin spokesperson Peskov said that it's absolutely, like, it's nonsense and it's absolutely not under discussion.
Reporting from the Ukrainian capital of Kyiv, Anna Chernikova. Anna, thank you.
Thank you, Steve.
Humanitarian groups have been on the ground in Ukraine since the war began, providing vital assistance to those in need. After nearly 9 months of Russian occupation, Ukrainian forces retook the southern city of Kherson. Recently, members from the non-governmental organization Save the Children went to Kherson. They report that families have been collecting water from puddles, and they've also been without power due to Russia's continued attacks on the country's civilian infrastructure, resulting in fatalities as well as injuries on Thursday. Georgia Tacey is the Ukraine Program Director for Save the Children, and I began our conversation by asking her to describe the bleak situation on the ground.
It's a very bleak and grim scene at the moment. You know, driving into Kherson, you can see that it was very much the forefront of a bitter battleground between the Ukraine and Russian forces. You have holes the size of swimming pools in the main highway leading up to the city that was caused by heavy artillery, completely decimated houses and gas stations and schools and shopping centers, completely razed to the ground as you enter the major region of Kherson. And then as you enter the more village community areas of the city, you can see that the people are very much still in shock. They're walking around. There's no fuel for cars, so people are all on foot carrying buckets of water that they are hoping to fill either at aid distribution points or anywhere they can find water from a river or small water source. You have queues, you know, 10,000 people deep trying to line up for the smallest of daily rations that were largely contributed by local organizations. You have people that are highly stressed, highly anxious. They have had no water, no electricity for over 2 or 3 weeks. And I guess they're just wondering what's next. And since I was there a few days ago, they have been under constant aerial bombardment. And so the anxiety and stress of families and children, and particularly those that have remained in the city, the people that had the financial resources left many, many months ago. So the people that remain in the city are people with limited means or limited support systems to go anywhere else. So we are really talking about the most vulnerable of the vulnerable. And so right now, they've got to really kind of think about the heartbreaking choice of do they stay and stay in their homelands and on their agricultural fields that are heavily contaminated with landmines and have no idea when electricity will come back and water, running water come back, or do they take the heartbreaking decision to get in the back of a truck and relocate somewhere else in the country with limited support and resources there as well.
You speak about the most vulnerable of the vulnerable and the people who did not have the means to leave Kherson and have been, you know, really under Russian occupation for almost 9 months. How many people, yeah, in your estimation are still there? Because part of the efforts of Save the Children was to distribute water and other means to help mitigate the horrific situation that you found. So how many people are there by your estimates, and can they all be helped?
Well, I think no one actually has the accurate level of data at the moment, but the pre-population was just under 300,000, and they think that has been reduced by at least half. And the short answer is, can we meet all those needs right now? We just simply can't, and I'm talking about the whole sector, let alone Save the Children. Just the sheer scale of destruction in terms of access to electricity and communications outside of Kherson, and the dangerous nature of actually getting in with all the contaminated landmines. It's incredibly difficult operating environment. We can't really assure the safety of everyone that goes in to help. So people are taking a huge amount of physical and personal risk to distribute aid. And so right now, there is not the amount of resources in Kherson to meet the immediate life-saving needs. Absolutely not.
One of the things I wanted to ask you about is that Save the Children and other organizations are distributing financial assistance to those in need as well, so they can purchase the goods that they have. But given the conflict and the difficulty of getting materials into these war-torn regions, what can they purchase, you know, logistically with these funds? What can they be used for?
That's a good question. So what we do when we distribute cash is we look at the markets and see what markets are open. Often with these situations, once people know that there will be money and a cash economy, you will see businesses take braver steps to return because they know that they will be able to set up business in Kherson. But right now, cash in people's hands is everything from allowing them to purchase food at a local farmer's market to get them through the day. It's allowing them to purchase pharmaceuticals and much needed medicine that can be shipped in by aid organizations and private organizations. And sometimes it's enough money to buy tablets for school kids to start doing remote school work on. And sometimes it's money to just help that entire family mobilize, get out of Kherson, and set up a family life somewhere else.
Georgia, what else are you concerned about?
Yeah, I think something that we worry about in our industry in general is compassion fatigue. I think we see everything on the news and it can sometimes be super overwhelming about what people can do. But I think something that I would really want to encourage everyone to do is to keep supporting Ukraine and not to look away from it. There is enormous amount of need and there'll be need here for decades to come. And one thing that really stands out to us about the people of Ukraine, it doesn't matter whether they're 8-year-old kids or 80-year-old women. When I was standing with them in the square in these food distribution lines, there are bombs going off that vibrate so heavily it hits you in the chest, you know, and these people don't even flinch because they're so used to living under such dangerous circumstances. And they're smiling and they're holding hands and they're saying that they won't be intimidated and that they believe in Ukraine and they believe in overcoming all this hardship. And so this is a people that really want to recover. And what they need right now is our support to recover. So I would just really encourage everyone to continue supporting aid coming into Ukraine and keeping them top of mind.
Georgia Tacey is Program Director with Save the Children in Ukraine. Georgia, thank you very much for sharing these stories today.
My pleasure.
British Foreign Secretary James Cleverly unveiled millions of dollars in additional support for Ukraine during a visit to Kyiv on Friday. Cleverly, who met with President Volodymyr Zelensky as well as Foreign Minister Dmytro Kuleba, condemned Russia for targeting civilians, hospitals, and energy infrastructure. Zelensky's office posted a video of the Ukrainian president shaking hands with Cleverly.
We are really thankful for and all our appreciation for all support of all the society, government, from Britain to Ukraine. Thank you so much. We are really friends.
Cleverly said Britain stood shoulder to shoulder with Ukrainians and announced a package of support for Ukraine ranging from ambulances to support for survivors of sexual violence carried out by the Russian military. And Britain's latest intelligence update says that recently mobilized Russian reservists continue to have problems. It says deployment is often characterized by confusion over eligibility for service, inadequate training and personal equipment, and commitment to highly attritional combat missions. For additional updates on the war throughout the day, visit voanews.com/flashpoint. You're listening to VOA's Flashpoint Ukraine. I'm Steve Miller. In 2022, the South Africa-based Brenthurst Foundation, which was established in 2005 to strengthen African economic performance, went to Ukraine with Tanzania's Zito Kabe. He's the leader of the Alliance for Change and Transparency, as well as a member of parliament. Also on that trip was Ugandan opposition leader Robert Kyagulanyi Ssentamu, better known as Bobby Wine. While there, Wine recorded a solidarity song with Lviv's own local band, String Mockingbird. Greg Mills is the director of the Brenthurst Foundation, and not only was he on the trip with the two African leaders himself, but also wrote the song you're hearing, Brothers in Freedom, which is sung by Bobby Wine and Ukrainian Sofia Grabovska. I reached Mills on his mobile phone while he was in Cape Town and began our conversation by asking him how this project came to be.
Well, a number of things. Firstly, I've been to Ukraine 5 times this year, and I was struck very much by not only the fighting spirit of Ukrainians, which of course is something that everyone in the world has become familiar with, but also the commonality of values between much of Africa and what the Ukrainians are fighting for. And so I see very big parallels between this African struggle for democracy and self-determination and rights and what the Ukrainians are doing. And of course, there's the anti-colonial component as well, anti-imperialism component to the Ukrainian struggle. And yet, majority of African countries are either ambivalent or some are even hostile towards Ukraine and pro-Russia. And that struck me as being, in a sense, synonymous with African views on democracy. So in routine polls, 70% of Africans prefer democracy to any other system of government. Yet today, if you follow Freedom House, for instance, over 90%, something like 93% of Africans live in countries which are either only partly free or unfree. So the minority of Africans, in spite of expressing their preference for democracy and the way in which they would determine their future and their rights, actually live in systems which don't allow this.
Greg, now this song includes Sofia Grabovska, String Mockingbird, a local Lviv band, as well as Bobby Wine, the famous Ugandan opposition leader and singer. How did all these people become involved in this song?
I thought to myself, well, what better way to have Africans identify with Ukraine and vice versa than by taking Africans to Ukraine? So we took African leaders of opposition movements to Ukraine. And, of course, one of them is Bobby Wine, who is the stage name of the Ugandan politician and leader of the opposition. And Bobby and I discussed beforehand about making the sort of connection between Ukraine and Africa more apparent to a wider audience through song. And we've worked together on songs before. We've co-written songs and co-performed songs. And I think that song is a very powerful medium, particularly with younger generations. And Bobby was up for the challenge. And on an earlier trip to Ukraine, I literally bumped into a band playing in the streets of Lviv called String Mockingbird. It was a three-piece string band. And we added the bandura, which was Sophia's actual real job, was to play the bandura, but she ended up singing on the two tracks. And we put the music together using String Mockingbird and Bobby and then some artists from South Africa. So it was an artistic collaboration across continents and was recorded in real time between two studios in Cape Town and in Lviv, with Bobby singing some of the tracks, Sophia singing some of the other tracks for the two songs. One, as you pointed out, Alone But All Together, was actually written as a COVID song. And we rewrote part of the tracks with Robin Ault and Murray Anderson in Cape Town, who I originally collaborated with in the production of the music. We rewrote this to reflect the circumstances in Ukraine more exactly and these parallels. And that was released a couple of months ago and has had, I think, to date, more than 100 million impressions on social media. And then a couple of weeks ago, we released Brothers in Freedom, which is a song really about detailing the cost of war, the solidarity of Africans to the war, and these common values which bring us together more than they divide us. And it's been a real pleasure to work with both Ukrainian and African artists in producing these.
I want to talk more about your relationship with music. You mentioned that music can be a very powerful medium, that you've performed before, you've written songs before, but you also have been involved with various reform projects throughout Africa. You've also served in the military, having done 4 tours in Afghanistan. But going way back in time, when did your relationship with music begin and how did it evolve to the point where, you know, you're working with international artists across continents to produce music?
It's a good question. You know, sometimes in life you just stumble into things. I played the drums when I was at school, and I've always been interested in music, and I suppose as my own career has developed and my own interests have developed, I have looked to music both for inspiration but also for expression. And a few years ago, the South African, very famous South African artist Johnny Clegg and I collaborated in a road show which we did in Europe and across South Africa and elsewhere in Africa, which was really about the path and progress of state development and state recovery. So while Johnny played his musical piece and his Zulu walking songs on the guitar, I then told the story of state development to audiences. And I thought it was a very powerful combination. Sadly, Johnny is no longer with us. But my collaboration then went to work with Robin Auld. And with every book that I have written or co-written over the last several years, we've had a song. And it provides a great foil in one respect to the written word and a different medium for getting a message across. But as I said, it also brings along a different audience. People are perhaps more easily seduced by listening to the radio and hearing the message than they are plowing through a 400-page book written by an academic. And I think that it's helped to expand awareness with audiences, helped to make people more conscious about what is the central message of the foundation that I work for, which is that development is a choice. And we need to express our choices in a way that is positive in terms of long-term trajectories. And we need to assert those choices. And these songs come back really to that fundamental principle, which is about the importance of expression, the importance of competitive choice, the importance of systems that allow individuals to do this, because this is, you know, has proven to be the best way forward. So I think songs are just a fantastic way of both personal expression and a way of reaching different audiences with a message that otherwise they wouldn't get to hear.
Dr. Greg Mills is the director of the Brent Hurst Foundation, based out of Johannesburg, South Africa, but we're speaking to him in Cape Town. Greg, thank you very much for sharing your story with us.
It's only a pleasure. Delighted to any time.
And here's a little bit more of Brothers in Freedom, sung by Bobby Wine and Ukrainian Sofia Grabovska, and performed by String Mockingbird. And that's going to do it for us this week. Be sure to stay up to date with our continuing coverage in Ukraine, as well as news and events from around the world. You can do so 24 hours a day at voanews.com, as well as on our social media feeds. Just be sure to follow VOA News. On behalf of the entire team at Flashpoint Ukraine, thank you for listening. Until next time, I'm VOA's Steve Miller. Be well, be safe, and good night.
This is the voice of America. Washington, D.C.